Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And today is really a gorgeous, gorgeous day here in New York. The sun is shining. The sky is blue. I don't see a cloud in the sky. Birds are singing, and the leaves are falling. And this time of year, with all the leaves falling, one thing we hear very often are those gas leaf blowers. And those have really been in the news lately. I had no idea how bad they were for the environment. I guess it's just one of those things you just don't really stop to think about. Gas leaf blowers came into action, I don't know how many years ago. You used to see people out there with the rakes, raking up the leaves. And I actually remember such fond memories of making big leaf piles and jumping in it. And, you know, those days seem to be gone with these gas leaf blowers. And turns out gas leaf blowers emit as much emissions into the environment as large automobiles do. And they just are really, really bad. Not only is it noise pollution, but it's really actual greenhouse gas pollution, too. So lots of localities are having or pushing to have bans. There's petitions around to ban gas leaf blowers. So I encourage all of you to, you know, make a decision for yourself, but look it up online, see how bad it is for the environment, and maybe you want to sign one of those petitions that you'll see around. A few weeks ago, I had a petition on my website for the town of Huntington. I know they are really pushing to try to outlaw gas leaf blowers, but they really are not a good thing. So that's something to really think about. Some other things in the news, you know, it's come into the news lately of all the pharmaceuticals and contaminants in our water. And even though our water treatment facilities, you know, are set up to filter out PCBs and the lead and other bad things that we know are in our water, they really are not set up to remove the increasing amount of pharmaceuticals that we're finding in our water. And most water, if you were to test it, you would find antidepressants in there, you'd find birth control pills in there, you'd find painkillers, chemo, medicine, all this stuff, you know. And yes, it's after it's already gone through one's body, so it's somewhat filtered, but what the body can't use comes out, and then it goes into our wastewater and through our water treatment facilities and back into our drinking water. So I just want you all to be aware of that and think about upgrading your water filter systems in your house, which I know I am in the process of doing. Gary Knoll, I know, has a great water filter that I'm looking into purchasing. And, you know, I know there's a lot of them out there, and the prices really range quite dramatically. But it's something to really think about, you know, when we go out of the house, like in everything, when we're out of the house and we're dependent on public places, you don't know what you're getting. But if most of the water you're drinking and the water you're filling your water bottles with comes from your home and you have a good water filter, then you are taking control and you know what you're having most of the time. And that's the best we can do. And, you know, with all these things, we can make ourselves crazy. And I really, you know, also try to adhere to the Buddha's middle path and not going too crazy, but at the same time being informed and making good decisions so that most of the time we're protecting ourselves. I was also shocked to hear that the use of antibiotics in livestock is going up. Now, that's something that, you know, I personally don't eat livestock, although I do eat organic eggs. But with all of the awareness of antibiotics and hormones in animals' feed and also being given to animals to keep them from getting sick, it's shocking to me that the use of it is actually going up instead of down. I mean, there's so much public outcry to reduce hormones and antibiotics in livestock, and yet studies have shown, and the Food and Drug Administration has found, that the use of antibiotics is actually going up. And I forget the actual statistic, but I think it's like 70% of all the antibiotics produced in this country goes towards livestock. That's a huge amount. So again, when you are purchasing meat or poultry, please, for the sake of your family and also for the environment and for the animals, please purchase organic, sustainably raised meat and poultry so that you're protecting your family and you're doing the right thing for the farmers and the ranchers and the environment. And then, of course, when you're out, you know, you try to go to the restaurants that are supporting those belief systems as well, but sometimes you just can't, or you're a guest at someone's house and you don't know what they're doing. So just, you know, get cooking so that most of the food that you are consuming and most of the water that you are drinking is coming from your own home, where you have control and where you can watch out and do the right thing. I do have a couple petitions on my website this week that I'd like to ask you to sign in on. And also, one way that you can really take action is this Saturday down in Long Beach, if you live on Long Island or wherever you live. This is an international global frackdown this Saturday. And so there's events going on all across the country and across the world. The local one here is in Long Beach. It's meeting at National Boulevard and the Boardwalk at 1 p.m. And actually, if you live in Huntington or the local area and you want to carpool, people are meeting at 11:30 at the Wild by Nature parking lot and carpooling over. But we really want to get a huge turnout. This is not only to protest the protest fracking and to try to keep the ban alive in New York State, but it's also to protest the construction of the Port Ambrose liquefied natural gas facility that they're planning on building out in the water off of the coast of New Jersey and Long Beach. And this facility would house huge amounts of gas, and there would be gas liners, you know, big ships filled with gas right out off our shores, and the likelihood of an accident from one of the boats or leaking pipes happen. And if Hurricane Sandy was to have happened while that facility was there, chances are there would have been lots of damage. We know how hard Long Beach was hit and the coast of New Jersey. So we don't want that out there. So please take a stand for fracking. Join the New Yorkers Against Fracking. Suffolk County also has a New Yorkers Against Fracking Facebook page you can sign on to. But get involved. We need everybody on board to keep fracking from coming to New York State. Also, you know, the issue with the pollinators is still out there. Honeybees are still hurting. And I have a petition to ask the EPA to ban the toxic chemicals that they're using, you know, the stronger pesticide that they are using that's really killing the bees, the neonicotinoids. So we want to keep those off of our field. So please sign that petition. Lots of things going on in the New York area in addition to the global frackdown this weekend. Food Day is October 24th, and that's being celebrated all month long in different ways. And actually today, after this show, I will be heading off to SUNY Farmingdale State College, where they're celebrating Food Day today. There's going to be cooking demos by moi, and there's going to be a farmer's market there. There's going to be presentations from local producers, farmers, educators, food activists. The Suffolk County Food Policy Council will be there. So lots of things going on for 10 to 4 all day today. And then in the evening, following the Food Day event, at 5:30 in the Sustainable Garden at SUNY Farmingdale, there's going to be a medicinal workshop and potluck. And that's only $5, and bring a dish to share. But that should be really great, and that's taking place in the Teaching Gardens at SUNY Farmingdale. Following that meeting, there will be a Slow Food North Shore meeting at 7:30 in the Student Center at Farmingdale. Then October 12th, Food Day celebrations continue with Slow Food East End, and that's going to be taking place in Sag Harbor at Dodd and Eder's Landscape Design Center from 4:30 to 7:30. That's a free community event. If you're out east, do go to that. It should be great. You can find out more about it on the Slow Food East End website. October 14th, Slow Food North Shore is continuing with their Film on Food series at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington. We'll be showing the documentary The Sturgeon Queen, which is a documentary about the food producers called Russ and Daughters down on the Lower East Side. They've actually opened a cafe this year, and I hear they're actually opening another cafe in one of the new museums that are opening. But this event will be on October 14th at 7:30, $14 for members of the Cinema Arts Center or Slow Food, and $19 for all others. And that includes a Q&A following the screening and with the director, and then also a full dairy reception. So that should be a lot of fun. October 15th, Edible Long Island is celebrating their one-year anniversary in Huntington at the Harbor Club at Prime. And that should be great from 6 to 9. You can go onto the Edible Long Island's website. And Edible, they have lots of great events, as do Slow Food. So if you miss any of my events, you can always go to my website at ieatgreen.com. But you can also go to Edible websites. There's Brooklyn, Edible Queens, Edible East End, Edible Long Island, and find out events. I am leaving next Thursday. I'll do my show and then head off to Terra Madre in Italy for the International Slow Food Conference, and I'm really, really excited to be there and represent Slow Food USA and Slow Food North Shore. So I'm very excited about that. October 23rd, while I'm gone, there will be a documentary screening of the movie Cowspiracy at the Sustainable Institute at Molloy's main campus. That's the one in Rockville Center. Usually they do it at their Sustainable campus in what town is this? Farmingdale. But this one is actually going to be in Rockville Center from 6:30 to 9:30. And October 24th, the New York Coalition for Healthy School Food is having their 10th anniversary gala. And I'll be really sad to miss that. I've been going for 10 years since they started, and the New York Coalition for Healthy School Food is a great organization. They're really bringing wonderful plant-based meals into New York City schools and other schools in the New York area. They actually sponsored their first all plant-based vegetarian school in Queens this year, and it's doing great. And November 2nd is the second annual New York City Sustainable Farm to Restaurant Producer Summit, and that's being sponsored by Slow Food New York City, and that's going to take place up at the Hawthorne Valley Farm in Ghent, New York. And believe it or not, it's only $30, which includes transportation from New York City, breakfast, lunch, and afternoon refreshments. I think that's a really great deal. Or you know, if you don't live in New York City, you can drive up. But anyway, you can go to the new Slow Food New York City website to buy tickets for that. And a great event that I want to share with you, November 8th at the Great Hall at Cooper Union, is going to be an event called Voices of Hope in a Time of Crisis. And there will be inspirational speakers from around the world. It's a whole day event from 10 to 5, discussions, and they're really trying to gather people who are movers and shakers, who are really, you know, want to roll up your sleeves and help, help during this time of crisis to really create a movement for our future in a sustainable way. So that should be a good event. Again, you can find out more about it on my website. And that is it for now. I want to share a recipe with you before I invite my guest on. My guest today is Kathleen Flynn. She is a chef and author of a great new book that just came out, Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good, a story of food and love from an American Midwest family. And she'll be coming on in just a little bit. First, let me just share this quick recipe with you. As you know, it is pear season. The pears are falling off my tree, and I had lots of pears, so I was trying to figure out what to do with it, and I decided to make a pear date chutney. Very simple and delicious. So I cut up the pears, I took out all the bruised parts, and I filled my measuring cup with 4 cups of diced pears. Then I added 1/2 cup of pitted dates that I chopped, 1 tablespoon of lemon juice, 1 tablespoon grated ginger, a pinch of salt, 2 cinnamon sticks, 1 tablespoon of jaggery, and that's like a raw sugar from India. If you don't have that, you can substitute, you know, honey or brown sugar and molasses. You only need a tablespoon, so, you know, it's almost, you know, not worth mixing brown sugar and molasses to get 1 tablespoon. So you just need something to cut the tartness. And my pears are not very sweet. I don't know what type of pear tree I have, but they never get ripe. They always stay hard, and they're not as sweet as some other pears. So I really needed that tablespoon of jaggery. If your pears are really sweet and ripe, you might not need it. So you might want to hold off on adding the sweetener and taste it first. I also added 1 tablespoon of fresh coriander chopped. Fresh coriander is the same as Chinese parsley or cilantro. They all have the same name. But 1 tablespoon of that, and then I also put 1/4 teaspoon of garam masala, and that is a blended mix of spices. It has cloves and cinnamon in it, as well as cumin and black pepper, and it's a great combo. If you don't have that, you can just add a little bit of cloves, a little bit of allspice, a little bit of coriander, you know, just dashes to spice in the chutney up. So I just, in the saucepan, I combined all of the pears, the dates, the cinnamon stick, the lemon juice, pinch of salt, the ginger, and the garam masala. And I cooked it for about 5 minutes, you know, so that it was really hot. And then I covered it and lowered the heat and let it simmer for about 20 minutes until the pears were really soft. And I stirred it occasionally so it wouldn't stick to the bottom. And then when it was finished, I added the fresh cilantro. And I tasted it, of course, hot right there, and it was delicious. Then I let it get to room temperature. I tasted it again, and it was delicious. And then last night I had it again, this time cold out of the refrigerator, and it was delicious. So any way you want it, it's really great. So enjoy that recipe, and serve it with, you know, any main course vegetable dish, especially if you have a spicy one. This just cuts some of the spiciness with sweetness, and it's delicious. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Kathleen Flynn. Kathleen is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Sharper Your Knife, The Less You Cry. And that came out in 2007. And that's a memoir with recipes about her experiences leaving the corporate world to head to Paris to study at Le Cordon Bleu. And, you know, and her experience and her falling in love all over there. So she's going to tell us about that. And then her second book, The Kitchen Counter Cooking School, How a Few Simple Lessons Transformed 9 Women into Fearless Home Cooks, was a book that she wrote after meeting some women in the supermarket who did not cook, and she helped to inspire them to cook and put it down into that book, and we'll find out more about that. But this latest book, Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good, A Story of Food and Love from an American Midwest Family, is a multi-generational memoir with recipes all about her culinary heritage growing up in Michigan, and that just came out this August. So I'm really so happy to have Kathleen on the show with me. Kathleen, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks.
Sure, welcome. So happy you could make it. So I want you to share with us this new book. I mean, we'll talk about some of the other books after, but first, this new book that you sent to me is just so great, Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good, and I love the name, Tales of Love and Food from an American Midwest Family. Can you tell us where that inspiration came from and where the name came from?
Yeah, so I actually had the idea to work on this book when I was actually working on my first one, The Sharper Your Knife, Less You Cry. And it was funny because I was writing about, you know, my life in Paris and falling in love. And you wouldn't think that that would really bring to mind a lot of stories about, say, a farm in the Midwest, which is where I grew up. But I kept finding myself going back to, you know, kind of my grandmother and my great-grandmother, and there are, you know, things that I learned about cooking. And I realized that, you know, the story about my wanting to get a degree in Paris and, you know, that being my lifelong dream, that it really started a long time ago, a lot earlier than I really ever probably realized. And so I ended up starting to collect stories about my family and thought, well, this would be kind of a nice little book. And, you know, I really don't actually know that much about my heritage, even though my sister-in-law is a professional genealogist. She actually does it for other families and is certified. She's done all this work on ours. And so I kind of had some heart, you know, idea about what was going on. But I didn't realize when I got into it that I would find out, say, that my grandfather was a bootlegger or that my other grandfather was a bigamist and that my last name shouldn't really be Flynn. I mean, it's kind of weird the things you find out when you go mm-hmm. looking for recipes. But the title came from my grandmother on my maternal side, my mother's mother, who used to say, oh, eat burnt toast, it makes you sing good. Everybody knows that. And she would make up all kinds of stuff, like, you know, eat rhubarb because it'll make you look like Marilyn Monroe. And, you know, she had all these weird stories. But it was her way of getting us to eat things we didn't want to because she never wanted to throw anything out. And she used to make all of her toasts in the oven. She did not believe in fads such as toasters because she could make uh-huh. her own toast. She would certainly toast it. I mean, but she would slice all of her handmade bread and she'd put it in this upper rack of her oven and broil it. And of course, you know, there was always a million grandkids around. She'd burn it. She had a lot of burnt toast. But when I thought about that,
it burns so quickly in the broiler. I mean, it goes, I've done it, you know.
Yes, yeah.
That's what I do with my garlic bread, and you just turn away for just that split second too much, and voila, it's burnt.
I know, but I liked the idea of it as a metaphor when I thought about it. And, you know, I mean, the sharper your knife, the less you cry is definitely a metaphor, and I liked this one, too, because I felt like it's kind of along the lines of what doesn't kill you makes you stronger kind of thing. I mean, burnt toast, you know, it's not necessarily something anybody particularly wants, but, you know, at the other end of it, you come out and you sing good. So, and there might be something to it, because actually I can sing, and most of my relatives can sing. I mean, we're not the Von Trapps or anything, but I definitely, everybody can, you know, has a pretty solid singing voice, seems like.
Uh-huh.
So maybe there's something to that.
Uh-huh. That's so funny. So so you started actually gathering these stories way before you actually wrote the book.
Yes, I did. And I was working on The Sharper Your Knife in 2006 when I actually had the idea for this book. And so I had been working on it really since then. Wasn't sure at what point, you know, kind of I whole plan for a bunch of books, where it would fall. And then in 2010, my mother, I was talking to her, and I said, hey, do you have Dad's, you know, chicken and dumplings recipe? Because I'm really trying to work on it. Cause I'm, you know, and at the time, the book was called The Farm on Coldwater Road was the original title for the book. And I ended up changing that title to Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good. One, I thought it just had, you know, it was very catchy and memorable. But I thought, The Farm on Coldwater Road had a little bit of a, I don't know, it could like be in cold blood or something. I don't know. So it mm-hmm. sounded like it could be like a little sinister or whatever. So, or a little bit darker than I wanted, you know, the title to be. But I said, oh, I'm working on that book and I'm looking for anything like notes or anything about his chicken and dumplings because I couldn't replicate them. And she said, well, let me look. And so she went up to, you know, went up and she has a million closets in her house, and she went to this closet and pulled down this box. And I started kind of rifling through it. And I was like, Mom, what is that? And she said, oh, nothing. And then I looked, and she had been writing stories. She'd written all these stories over, I don't know, like a 30-year period about their life living on the farm. I mean, her and my father. And she kind of interviewed my father about his life growing up during the Great Depression as a little kid. And she'd written about the years they lived in San Francisco and all this stuff and stuff, memories about her own grandmother who I never met. And I just was kind of taken aback. I was like, Mom, you know, I've been working on this book. Like, why have you ever shown this to me? And she said, oh, well, you know, I'm not a real writer. I mean, you and your sister are really writers. And I was kind of embarrassed. And I went through and read them all, and they were wonderful. I mean, they were just sort of memories, like stuff uh-huh. that she remembered, you know, and just kind of little vignettes. So
And then I kind of was like, Mom, I'm a memoir writer. This stuff is really valuable to me. I can't believe you didn't show it to me before. Uh-huh. But that's why there's so much detail in the book. I've gotten a lot of questions about that because I'm not in the book for about a third of it. I mean, I don't show up until about chapter six. Uh-huh. And it's all this stuff about, you know, my great-great-grandparents and my dad as a little kid and all this stuff. And it's really because of my mother, because my mom had written all this stuff down. Uh-huh. And it was just invaluable. But
right. And your
yeah.
family actually, they had a food business, right? A pizzeria?
Yeah, they did. So my parents, and it's such a weird thing because my mother is Swedish-American and my dad was, or at the time he thought, Irish-American. And my other uncle, who is also Irish, he moved out to San Francisco, and he ended up starting this Italian restaurant where the big thing was pizza. And we kind of forget, you know, in the 1950s, pizza was still an ethnic food. I mean, you didn't get it everywhere. I mean, it was kind of unusual. My parents had only had it once, eating out.
Wow.
And, yeah, and Chef Boyardee literally had come out. I think it came out in 1958. The Chef Boyardee kit was brand new. The whole make your own pizza home thing.
Uh-huh.
And so they packed up everything and left, you know, Michigan because there was a big recession in the late 1950s. And they drove across America on Route 66 until they got to San Francisco. And they went and they worked. And my dad worked at my Irish uncle's Italian restaurant. And he learned how to be a cook. And he did that for over a year. And then they ended up moving out of San Francisco to Marysville. And they started their own restaurant. And it didn't last very long, and primarily because, you know, kind of this Central California is much warmer during the summer, and they didn't have any air conditioning, and they had pizza ovens. And that kind of equation just
right.
didn't work out because they ended up just nobody came and ate there for about 3 months because it was too hot. So they ended up closing up the restaurant, and my dad ended up getting a less stressful job working as a police officer, which I, you know.
Less stressful?
Random segue, but it's funny as a result though, my parents, my father in particular, I mean, I guess we always think of, you know, women cooking and kind of that, you know, sort of the classic sort of gender, you know, roles in the family. But I guess I didn't grow up with those because my father always cooked. Both of my parents cooked, and I just thought everyone cooked. And I think it had a big effect on me
mm-hmm.
that I never really identified that particularly with my mother because my dad would come home and cook a lot too. And he was, because he'd worked as a professional cook, I mean, he really knew his way around the kitchen and was very fast chopping things. And, you know, and if there was a big family dinner, I mean, my dad did a lot of the prep and it was something that my parents really did together. And I don't know that I really recognized that my father cooked had such a big impact on me until I worked on this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you grew up, so in Michigan you had a farm. What did you grow? Did you also raise animals or just vegetables? What kind of farm was it?
We had chickens. My parents had this brilliant idea to get some chickens, and they moved into this kind of ramshackle farmhouse, and they went to go pick up, according to my mother, about 20 chickens, but they ended up leaving with 250 chickens.
Oh my God.
It was such a bad idea. They had this incubator that they found in this farmhouse when they first moved in like 1962 or whatever, and they stuffed all these little baby chicks in it because they were so cheap. I think they were like 2 cents a piece or something. And they shoved all these little baby chicks in there. And of course, they got too big. And then they moved them out to this chicken coop. And they just had so many chickens. They were just spending a fortune feeding these chickens. And so my mother ended up actually having to dispatch about 100 chickens and a couple, like, over the course of 2 weeks with quite the production. And they ended up, over time, kind of pulling that flock back down to about 20 or 25 chickens. And that's how
uh-huh.
many chickens they had for years. I mean, we had chickens when I was little, and it was always about 20 chickens or so. Then we had a very large orchard within Michigan, and I think they had 6 different kinds of apples. a couple different kinds of pears. We had a massive mulberry tree. And then, of course, we had our garden. And in the garden, my parents kind of grew everything. My grandfather grew beans, and he knew a lot about growing beans. He grew every kind of bean he could grow, and he could get seed for. So we also grew beans and dried them, too, which is funny because
I
think people forget, like, you know, beans, you grow them and then you dry them. So when you buy them in the store, I was talking to someone about it, and they just, the whole concept seemed kind of mind blowing to them. But yeah, we grew beans and we grew corn and, you know, all the usual kind of garden staples. And, you know, it's kind of funny when I look back at it, it's kind of, there's stuff that we used to grow that you don't really see in stores anymore, like falsifi. We used to grow that when I was a kid because my grandparents had it in their gardens. And we had a lot of squashes, like a lot of different kinds of squashes. And you kind of see them. I think that now, you know, because people don't tend to eat a lot of squash, you really only see like three or four different kinds of squashes in the supermarket. But my recollection as a kid, my mom confirmed that, we had about 8 or 9 different kinds of squashes because they were easy to grow. And they would plant them, you know, kind of as some of the early summer crops, you know, went kind of finished their kind of, you know, their kind of thing. And they would go back and replant them with squashes because then they could grow even up until, I mean, basically until it starts snowing. And so,
right.
I mean, a huge pumpkin patch and a lot of watermelon and that kind of stuff. So I can remember vividly sitting in the strawberry patch and just picking strawberries and eating them. It was such a great experience.
Right. So most of the farming, though, was for your own family sustainability. It wasn't a business.
Definitely. No, it wasn't a business per se, although we did actually sell a lot of, particularly my parents had a lot of chickens. They would sell eggs, and we also sold apples, which my mother reminded me of recently.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had so many apples. We had just a big orchard, and like multiple, like I think 20 trees or something like that. So we also sold apples, and it's funny because my parents didn't use any pesticides of any kind, so they just sprayed everything with soapy water. My dad had this big gun, and he'd put soap in it. He'd just spray everything because they didn't believe in using pesticides. And we were one of the only farmers, like farm families around that didn't use them because, you know, your yields would be higher and all this other stuff. But my great-grandmother was still alive then, and she didn't believe in pesticides. So she
good
was
for
sort
her.
Of, yeah,
she was
right?
ahead of her time.
Yeah, and she was. And she said, whatever, you know. So you know, that's okay. You know, you'll get worms in your apples, but, you know, you can just cut them out. And it's like, you got plenty of apples. Let the worms have a few. So we never had any pesticides on any of our food when we were growing up. And it's funny because I can remember sort of apples, you know, were not perfect like they are in the store. And, you know, every so often you'd be going and you'd be shucking some corn or something and there'd be something in it. I mean, that's how stuff grows, you know. But it was a great experience. The other thing my mother did is she canned an extraordinary amount of food. So she used to put up, I think, somewhere between around 400 to 500 jars every year, basically at the end of summer and into autumn. She did, like, you know, 80 jars of tomatoes, I mean, 80 pints of this, you know, lots and lots of jams. I mean, she did green beans and pickles. I mean, she did it all. And because it was so expensive, you know, in the 60s and early 70s to go to the store and buy, like, say, canned tomatoes. I mean, it's a lot cheaper now, relatively speaking. And but that way they just, you know, she says, sunshine and the jar and, you know, some tomatoes, a little salt. That's, you know, that's what a quart of tomatoes cost. And
right.
So that's, you know, that was sort of the rhythm of their life. I mean, they lived on the farm. We lived on the farm for about 17 years. I was about 7, almost 8 when we moved. But I think that part of the reason that I look back so fondly on those years is because it just seemed like such a simpler time. I mean, our our food was pretty simple and it was
right.
pretty good. And, you know, it just...
Right, a simpler time, but also to have the time to jar, to can.
Yeah, I know.
400, 500 jars. I mean, you know, I'll do a day of pickling or canning some stuff, and, you know, I'm lucky if I get 20 jars done, you know, and it took me all day.
Yeah, well, my mother completely believed in the idea of child labor, so we all... She did not, like, have any problem with saying, okay, you wash out these jars, you do this, you chop this, da 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 da. I mean, we all learned to cook really early, too. I mean, I was telling somebody that, you know, I taught my niece how to use a knife when she was about 7, and this woman was mortified. And I said, well, it's not like I'm letting her run around the house with a chef's knife, but she's sitting there and, you know, taught her to be careful and safe. And, I mean, she...
Kids are very capable. I mean,
I
often, you know, teach parents how to bring their children into the kitchen. And it is, you know, it is so empowering to get to let a child know that you trust them with this adult tool and that you believe in them, that they can handle this. And you teach them the safety. And they have good fear. They know they don't want to get cut. So they're very careful and they're very focused. I'm quite impressed with my little helpers in the kitchen, you know, and I love to have parents do that, you know, to get their kids involved.
Yeah.
When I want to take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I want to share an opposite story that I have of my experience in the kitchen with my mother. So,
great.
Everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Kathleen Flynn, author of Burnt Toast. Wait a minute. Where is it? Ah! Say it for me.
Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good.
Thank you. Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good. Everyone, we'll be right back. You're listening to Bhavani and I.E. Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm with my guest today, Kathleen Flynn, author of the new book, Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good, a story of food and love from an American Midwest family. Kathleen, you with me?
Yes, I am.
So I'm loving your stories, and it's so opposite, you know, what my experience was. I mean, you grew up where there was cooking around you, and that was just part of the rhythm of your life and the seasons. My mother was a product of an only child in New York City who was, you know, expressing herself in the 50s with her newfound freedom. And so she believed in buying all those cans and frozen foods that you could get at the supermarket and doing, you know, as little cooking as possible. So, I mean, she, you know, do whatever she did to the meat and stick that in the oven, but then the side dishes and the vegetables were all an afterthought. The only real vegetables I ever saw in my house were for making a lettuce salad with iceberg lettuce, cucumbers, tomatoes, carrots, celery.
Yeah.
Maybe. But everything else came out of a can or was frozen. And I remember when I decided to become a vegetarian, I had not eaten many vegetables growing up because the vegetables we had were canned or frozen. I bought myself a wok and I opened a can of Veg-All. Do you know what Veg-All is?
Yes, I do.
A can of Veg-All, and that's what I put into my wok to cook. And, you know, that's how far, you know, that was my experience, and that's what I thought cooking vegetables was. So I had a real long way to come. But it's just so funny how different people's experiences are. So I just love your story.
I think your story is one that is more common than mine. I mean, and certainly today. Even we have friends who are visiting, and I was looking at sort of, they said, oh, well, we bought a bunch of food, you know, for their daughter who we were watching for a couple of days. And, you know, and these are like, you know, very well educated, normally eat pretty well kind of people. So I was surprised how much processed food there was. I mean, and it's no judgment on them. I mean, I think that it's just really hard to have kids and cook and, you know, what, you know, and it's also what kids get used to eating. And, but it was kind of, I was sort of, wow, you know, it's kind of processed cheese and, you know, granola bars that have like the longest shelf life I've ever seen. And, you know, and I mean, there are some interesting things like applesauce in a tube, which I think is actually a pretty extraordinary development. It's actually a good idea. But, but you know, I was, it was interesting how it really kind of underscored sort of that is sort of normal food. Does that make any sense? I mean, she'll grow up like always thinking, oh, I used to love these chocolate-covered granola bars when I was a little kid, because that's her life, you know, and that's like what she's eating. And I think that is, that's how kids eat. You know, I mean, I think that the parents have the time, the energy, and you know, whatever wherewithal to really cook or can or whatever, you know, I think that that is not the normal you know, world that kids grow up in now. And it, and it's kind of sad, but I don't know. I don't have kids.
Well,
so I,
no, I
feel
think
like I'm one of those people who just, here's how you should feed your kids, but I don't have any.
Right. So. Well, this, you know, I think it's, you know, your mission, my mission. I mean, for so many of us who do have that passion for cooking and know how much better the food is. And what happens also is when you are a chef, you can't help but learning more about our food system and being alarmed by what is in our food. I mean, you'd have to be in a bubble if you didn't, you know, become aware of the processed foods that so many of us are eating. And so you focus in on it, and once you know what's in the food, you really don't want to go there if you have an option. I don't know if you heard the beginning of my show when I was just saying, you know, you have, you know, you have to make choices, and you know, as parents, we really have that opportunity to make those choices. I was talking to some people yesterday, just saying how when we were kids, we used to eat seasonally, just because that, you know, watermelon was only available in season.
Corn on the cob was only available in season,
and you'd look forward to it all year, and how exciting that was, and how, you know, when you can have watermelon salad year-round, it's just not the same.
No, it's really true. And, I mean, I think that, you know, there's not much in terms of seasonality in our foods if you look at a supermarket. I mean, I actually went in the store. I love my supermarket. I spend a lot of time there. And so, but, you know, I was looking around and I thought, wow, one of the few things you see there that's actually kind of seasonal are pumpkins. I mean, it's because all of a sudden there's just a bunch of pumpkins, and you never see pumpkins the rest of the year.
Right.
And, you know, and it really struck me that, you know, I walked through the rest of the produce section, and it looked exactly the same as it always does.
Year-round,
I mean, berries, year-round, and, you know, and it is true. I think that, if, like, even with our friend's daughter who was over, I said, oh, you know, hey, let's, you know, try some different, she doesn't like to try a lot of different foods, which is okay because she's a little kid. But, you know, I said, hey, you know, we can make some carrot juice. Woo! Got at the Vitamix. We made some carrot juice. And she liked it, you know, because she never had it. She said, no, I don't like it. And I'm like, have you ever had it? No, I haven't had it. But I was going to, I was actually thinking today that I might go and get a pumpkin and go and just roast the pumpkin so she can see, like, you can really actually eat the pumpkin. The pumpkin is actually something that, you know, started out as something for you to eat. So, because I think she only sees it as a jack-o'-lantern and doesn't really, you know. And I remember as a kid, my parents, we always got the pumpkin seeds and, like, roasted them and stuff.
Oh, yeah. It's so much fun to do.
I love roasting pumpkin seeds.
Right.
And to me, it reminds me of being, like, 8 years old and so excited. I really could not wait to, like, get into my princess outfit and, like, go trick-or-treating. So, but
well, you know, also for children, for children, their whole year is, you know, is through the rhythms of holidays, really, and celebrations. I mean, that's how they mark their calendars, you know, and it starts, the year usually starts like in September with school, and then, you know, it moves on to Halloween, then it moves to Thanksgiving, then it moves to, you know, either Christmas or Hanukkah or Kwanzaa or whatever holiday you celebrate, and then Valentine's Day, and then St. Patty's Day, and then Easter, and then, you know, Passover if you celebrate that, and then, you know, I mean, that's, those are the cycles and the rhythms, and there's usually certain foods that are associated with those, those holidays, and that's, you know, really the richness of, you know, a child's world. And so as parents, if you know that, you can really try to give them some of the joys of the seasonality, even if you know that in the supermarket you can really get everything. Mm-hmm. But yeah, knowing yourself what's really in season and what things are worth buying when. And
Yeah, we actually went out on my porch, and I live in Seattle, and it's been really beautiful here this last few days. And the very last hangers-on in my tomatoes are finally, I have a terrible, like, track record with growing tomatoes. It's just, I think part of it's just I grow them in containers, and I'm in Seattle, and it just isn't hot, whatever. But I finally have, like, the last of my tomatoes are red and ready to harvest. And so we went out and we picked them. And she was pretty mesmerized by that. You know, she said, wow, you have tomatoes out here. And I said, yeah, and we have lettuce. And I showed her, because I grow my own lettuce in containers out of my, you know, patio, because why not? So easy. And we also had Swiss chard, and so we cut it off and we did it. And she was just so interested. And I can tell you that this kid doesn't eat a lot of green stuff, but she was very excited to try the lettuce and the kale and the tomatoes, because that just seemed like a miracle to her, that we just went out on the back porch and we went and we harvested them. Yeah.
Right. Oh. Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, I have firsthand seen that when you work in a garden with kids, they will eat things that they normally wouldn't eat. I mean, if they grow it, they're so much more likely to, or they pick it, so much more likely to eat it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's one of the reasons why I really, when I grew up, I don't remember having any food I didn't like, except for possibly I wasn't crazy about rhubarb.
Mm-hmm.
But the only thing I didn't really kind of really love as a kid, I think.
Mm-hmm. Unless it was in strawberry rhubarb pie.
Yeah, no, totally, right? But most of my grandmother used to say rhubarb would make you look like Marilyn Monroe. And I think it was because it was her way of, I think some of the other kids didn't like it too, which may have also informed me to think like, oh, rhubarb isn't good because other kids didn't like it. Because kids are so affected by what other kids like. You know, they don't really, it's one of those kind of group things, I think. So, which is one of the reasons she likes one of her snacks, is because the kids, the kind of cool kids at her kindergarten, I think, like it. So that makes it more delicious, apparently.
Well, that's why when, you know, I've been involved in school lunch programs, and, you know, I ran the cafeteria at our local Waldorf school, and I saw how you can actually use peer pressure in a positive aspect, where, you know, if you make the food really good, even though, you know, for some kids it's different, when they see other kids eating it and loving it, it makes them want to have it. And we had a big, beautiful salad bar, and, you know, people said, oh, the kids will never eat, you know, the skeptics, oh, the kids will never eat the salad bar. Well, that salad bar was hopping, you know. People just were loving it, and I think the administration was really shocked because they did not expect kids to want to eat that food. And the ones that didn't, I mean, I have parents coming up to me all the time going, how did you get my child to eat salad? They would never eat salad. And I think also one of the keys is putting real homemade salad dressing on it.
Right.
You know, I always go crazy when I see people setting up salad bars and then putting, like, Kraft Thousand Island dressing out on a salad bar and defeating the whole purpose.
Yeah, it's funny, though. You know, so my second book, which was called The Kitchen Counter Cooking School, you know, that book was about a project that I did trying to understand what holds people back from cooking. Like, why do people end up eating a lot of convenience foods? And
what do you find?
I found that some of it was confidence, a lot of it was, that, or just, you know, people didn't feel like they knew how to cook. And I ended up doing 10 weeks of lessons with all these volunteers, and then I followed them for a year to see what can you teach people that is actually truly impactful. And the weird thing was, number one was knife skills, which didn't really surprise me after having done the classes. And now whenever I do a lesson or do anything, any demo, I always demo knife skills because invariably people don't know how to use their knives. I wish we taught that, like in high school, instead of like Elizabethan poetry or something. But number two is how to make a vinaigrette. And I was really surprised by that because so many people, you know, just didn't get that it was just oil and water and, I mean, oil and vinegar and, you know, a little salt and pepper. And like, yeah, you put it in a jar and, you know, you just shake it.
That's right.
And people, and, you know, and it's kind of expensive to buy vinaigrettes. And if you want different flavors of vinaigrettes, it takes up a lot of space in your fridge. And that was one of the main changes that I saw with that group and was around salad dressing. And it's such a simple thing to learn.
It's such a simple thing, right?
Yeah, the
Asian dressing that people always get in the Japanese restaurants, they think it's so hard and it's so simple.
Yeah, but, and I always try to teach that too, because oil and vinegar are like, you know, my two sisters-in-law. I mean, they just don't. It takes a lot to get them together, you know, and keep them there. And there's so much, you know, stuff in salad dressing. And you know, I said the next time you go. Recently just did this cooking class and I showed people how to do it. And I said, oh, if you want it fancy, you can add some jam and, you know, balsamic vinegar and whatever. It's like, you know, so straightforward. They said, you know, there are only three ingredients or four ingredients in this. If you count the salt and pepper, but the next time you go to a supermarket, I want you to pick it up, look at the back, you know, the back label and see how many things are in it. And somebody wrote me this morning, actually, while I was getting ready to talk to you and said, you won't even believe it. I picked up a bottle of salad dressing and there were 18 ingredients in it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And,
like,
you definitely don't need that gar gum, you know, when you see those, all the herbs, like, you know, floating in space in the salad dressing, you know, God forbid they sink and you have to shake the bottle.
Exactly. I mean, right.
You know, people have decided, like, we can't shake bottles. You know, we have to have pre-shook salad dressing and have, you know, everything suspended in the salad dressing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It has to be photo ready all the time.
So going back to that book, because I love that story, after you followed those women, were you able to impact them? Did your skills stay with them?
Yes, actually, they did. And I would say I had about 9 or 10 volunteers that are followed in the book, but I actually did a wider kind of, I was going to do as a documentary, which I haven't done, but I ended up having about another 20 people who also went through a very similar project as well, kind of the same project at a different time. And what I found was that about 70% of the people who went through that did and changed their cooking and eating habits in some way. In some cases, it was just eating a lot less fast food. I mean, or just a lot less convenient food because they realized it wasn't that difficult to cook. In some cases, people really did a pretty major overhaul. I mean, they cooked a lot, you know. I mean, once they were like, really, once you get past setting stuff up and you have enough confidence to follow a recipe, that's a huge part of it.
Right.
The more difficult, I think the people who were the most motivated and found it the most difficult were actually people with small children. Because I think that, you know, Americans have this, a lot of two people were, oh, I don't have time to cook. But it's really time poverty is kind of a concept that Americans have.
Right.
And really realistically
don't. And it takes longer to go out and get the things than it does to make it half the time.
Right.
And keep yourself stocked.
But
anyway,
Kathleen,
we're out of time.
Definitely.
Okay, I can't believe how fast this hour went.
That's great. That was great talking to you.
It was great having you on. Thank you so much for joining us. And everyone, you can find, Kathleen, why don't you share with everyone your website so they can get to you?
Oh, sure. You can find me at cookfearless.com is my main website. And if you put my name, Kathleen Flynn, and it's F-L-I-N-N with an I, not a Y, you'll find me very easily. And it also goes to kathleenflynn.com.
Great. And I have a link, of course, from my website, too. Kathleen, thanks so much. Everyone out there, have a great rest of the week. I hope we see you at the Global Frackdown. And sign those petitions. We need everyone out there to become activists. Have a great rest of the week.